BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's dialect. Dialect is back on the air for the autumn. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre and is part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Sue Fairbanks is with us here in the studio to talk about nuclear trains travelling through Bristol. And we also have Roy D. Hacksaw from local punk group Hacksaw to talk about the group and his new album. Tony Gosling has a feature on squatters living on Ashley Road, and there is an interview with Sharon MacDonald, who set up a business selling New Age goods and services. There is no Matt's Muses this week as he is ill, gutted. Get well soon, Matt. Malcolm Grieve continues with another chapter of Cider with Rosie, and Jess Barks is back with us this week for another edition of What's Going On. I'm John Peters Coleman, and I have Sue Fairbanks with me in the studio now to talk about nuclear trains. Hello, Sue.
Hello.
You're a filmmaker, Sue, I understand, and you've made a 15-minute short film that was commissioned. Tell me a little bit about the commission.
The film was commissioned by Southwest Screen and the Community Channel for the Community Channel to be played on the Community Channel and on the web.
Okay. Now, you had a long-standing interest in nuclear trains before the film was commissioned, so explain a little bit about why you're interested in nuclear trains. How did that come about?
It started in 2006 when I read a newspaper article about a train that carried a flask containing spent nuclear fuels from submarines from Devonport in Plymouth to Sellafield, and they'd put the lid of the flask on incorrectly, so it essentially could have been leaking. Luckily, apparently, it wasn't leaking, but this train travels about 50 metres away from my home, and this sort of sparked my interest. I didn't know that these things were moving about the country. Of course they do, and I, like everybody else, had my head deeply underground and just ignored it. But then an interest formed and I decided I'd like to just tell people about it.
Okay. I mean, did you get in touch with any sort of locally concerned groups? Are you anti-nuclear generally, per se, in terms of nuclear fuel?
I am now, yes. Yes. Before I was slightly, yes, but now I know more. I am even more concerned about the new generation MOX fuel generators that the government plan.
I mean, given what we're told is sort of the wonderful green future that we could have courtesy of nuclear fuel, what have you got against nuclear? Why do you think there are more cons against it than pros for?
Well, I'm not a nuclear spokesperson, and I haven't got massive in-depth knowledge. But from what I've gleaned is that the nuclear industry at the moment, because there are so many defective reactors, not so much nuclear power is being made anyway. There are a lot of old reactors that need decommissioning, and I can't remember offhand the percentage, but it was only about 8% of energy was produced. And this energy could be produced by wind turbines and sea resources, or the ways of capturing the sea's energy.
Yeah.
And the argument that it's a low carbon way of producing fuel, actually once you make it, it's low carbon, but it has to be mined, it has to be processed, it has to be transported, usually from another country, Australia, for example, and then transported again through England, and then transported again up to Sellafield, and then stored, sorry.
Okay, well, there's a lot, yeah, as you point out, quite accurate, yeah, there's a lot of energy that goes into it that is outside of what they calculate. In terms of just the processing of the fuel itself once it's there, which is a good point. So what did you do to go about making a film about it? How did you decide who to speak to and what to do? Who did you speak to?
Well, the film is really quite one-sided. I don't really go into a nuclear debate. I more essentially tell people this is happening. So I decided to follow the train from Bristol to Sellafield, and on the way discuss it with people. But as a poor filmmaker, I had to get a job and this didn't really work out. So I made it a different way and made it in a very evocative, slightly experimental film, and talked to people at Greenpeace and local activist in Sellafield who has quite a lot of experience demonstrating against nuclear power. And then finally actually did talk to somebody on the other side who wrote a report about plutonium storage.
Okay. So you're really hoping that people are going to be motivated to find out more about nuclear. So this is sort of an average person who's living by the side of a railway line who initially didn't know anything about it, this is sort of what you've discovered off your own back, so that you can show people they can.
Yes, I think the problem is that this waste doesn't just travel through from Plymouth to Sellafield. The waste travels all the way through the country, through major conurbations, and quite open to terrorist attack. At one point, a reporter from the Daily Mirror, he actually gained access to and stood by a train and potentially could have put a bomb on it. Of course, he didn't, had his photograph taken. And there are real concerns that these are very weak targets, really. It's very easy to attack one of these trains. There aren't any methods of security. There aren't any guards. Just one person or maybe two people on a train.
So what do you hope people might do if they go to see this film in response to it?
I'm hoping that people are just made aware that there are now ideas to build more reactors, and the reactors that they will be building, the public aren't aware of this, but the nuclear waste at the moment is highly radioactive, and in the future the fuel made from separated plutonium will be even more radioactive, and that will be transported across England to the new reactors, and then once that fuel's burned, the spent fuel will be even more radioactive. So we have kind of an increase of radioactivity, and this is going to be buried. The idea is that this will be buried in the English countryside somewhere. And I think the question is, do people really want this on their doorstep when there are other ways that are potentially cheaper, they're green, and there's less of a danger?
So how many films have you made before? Do you have a long-standing interest in filmmaking, or is this a new thing?
Yes, I've made a few films, but this is the first one to be commissioned.
Okay, so you as an amateur sort of filmmaker, what sort of basic equipment did you sort of use? Are you sort of a home enthusiast? Were you a sort of home enthusiast DIY filmmaker just from your own interest until now? Or?
Yes, I tried to make professional films for TV, but realised that the sort of films I make don't carry enough jeopardy or conflict and would actually never be commissioned. I have my own equipment, but we shot on Sony equipment, and it was just me. It was a very low-budget production.
What sort of stuff have you made films about before?
Deaf children dancing.
Yeah.
And ice swimming.
Ice swimming. So that is swimming in sort of icy cold water, basically?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. Where can people find out any more about you? Are you on the internet or anything like that?
No, I don't have a website, but you can see a couple of my films. You can see Deadly Silent Cargo, which is the nuclear waste film, and you can see No Diving, which is another short sort of drama, and the other films aren't available yet.
Okay, so where can people see find out more about the film that you've just made about nuclear trains?
You could try the Community Channel website. Otherwise, there's a website called Yoast, which is Dutch, JOOST.com. You could find it there. It might be somewhere else. I don't know. No Diving, you can find that on MySpace. So, yes.
Okay, well, Sue Fairbanks, very best of luck for the future. And it was very interesting to hear about something that a lot of people out there may not necessarily know. If you catch a train from Temple Meads, trains carrying nuclear waste rocket through that station and through Somerset and South Gloucestershire. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Running between Stokes Croft and St Paul's, Ashley Road, which many of you may be familiar with, was the scene of a standoff between squatters and police last week. The squat, apparently, is one with a big banner outside which says, "Don't privatise our housing," as you walk along Ashley Road. And the building is owned by Quasi Housing Association, Places for People. And the housing was housing a number of determined homeless people. And the bailiff and the police turned up last Tuesday morning to evict them. The squatters said they decided to stay where they were because they'd been evicted from another people's places for people building a few doors down, and the building had been left empty. And this is a classic Bristol phenomenon. There had been no attempt to let out the flats. So Dialect's Tony Gosling spoke to two of the squatters.
Hello, I'm Ben Ritchie with Bristol Housing Action Movement. I went down to 87 Ashley Road because I got a call on the emergency telephone line to go and help people who seem to be facing immediate eviction. I went down, there was a very big crowd of people already out in the street and in the house, and I just started to help with the barricading and other things that had to be done.
Hello, my name is Ashes Daly, and I got a call actually from Ben to get over there. And I say there was about probably 30-odd on the pavement in the end, and a few was in the garden at the front, and just basically put some more barriers up to help keep the police out. Yeah, they were already there. There was police and probably about three van loads of people to put the Cytex back on.
Okay, can you just explain what sort of building it was and how many people had actually been living there?
I'm not sure. I've never actually been there before. It's a big building. I think there might be a dozen or so live there. I really don't know.
Yeah, I think it's about a dozen to 15 people living there. It's a Places for People property, been empty for some time before they squatted it, I think in May of this year.
Okay, so this is something that's in a lot of people's minds, is evictions. Now, this was a squat. A lot of people that are actually pay mortgages are also thinking in their own minds as well about evictions. Can you just explain what is an eviction actually like? What happens?
The bailiffs turn up with a warrant to get people out, I suppose. Apparently they were given a week's notice, but didn't receive it, and hence they all turned up mob-handed with the police there.
So roughly how many bailiffs and how many police?
There was only one bailiff, which is why he was caught by surprise. There was at least one big riot van police and a couple of police cars and Orbis, the security firm, as well.
So the police are there basically just to intervene if there's any dispute, is that right? Or what? Who has what roles in the eviction itself?
I think, first of all, the bailiffs will try and gain entry, but ultimately the police will also help to enforce an eviction order if it's being resisted.
So what actually happened then?
Not a great deal. We put up some barriers in the howling rain and sleet. It just didn't happen. They backed off, basically. They could see they were not going to get in very easily. I guess they'll come back and try again.
So it's just simply physical barricading of the front door?
Of everywhere. I won't go into detail, but it's a very hard house to get into anyway because of high walls around it.
I'm also sort of interested in this whole idea of what is, a lot of people are afraid of eviction at the moment. Do you think there is any, as we've seen on Tuesday, more of a possibility of this kind of thing in the future? Because, we're looking at lots of buildings, lots of squatters in Bristol, for example, as well, that may be evicted. Is it something that, how do you decide whether to actually resist one or not?
I think the basic old premise of squatting is that you're dealing with people that a lot of them would be on the streets otherwise. Okay, for some it's a lifestyle choice. We can't afford to get in the housing ladder. A lot of people are unemployed for various reasons, some of them medical. What can they do? Where can they go? So we squat. And they're empty buildings, so why not?
I think decision when to resist really depends on the attitude of the housing association or the council. Places for People have taken these particular squatters to court at least 6 times, failing to get them out, but they have been harassing them ever since they squatted. The squatters have attempted to negotiate with Places for People during all this time, saying your place isn't being used, why not give us an agreement? Even now, when they manage to become legal owners of the property again, Places for People took the opportunity to get the people out as fast as they possibly could. They could actually give them to well over Christmas, New Year to get them out, but no, Places for People have vindictively tried to get them out as fast as possible. So it's this kind of thing where the owner looks like they're just out to get homeless people that people decide, right, we're going to resist.
But the owner would say, we need to use this building, and it is our building, and we've got an obligation to house people in there, so we need to get back possession of it.
Well, that's why 141 Ashley Road, further down the road, is still empty. It's been empty for the length of time 87 Ashley Road's been squatted. That's owned by Places for People. Across the road, the buildings that Places for People did own are now flats for sale. So what are Places for People doing, restricting the amount of property that they own for tenancies by selling it off?
Well, isn't that their right? I mean, they do own the buildings, don't they?
They're a charitable organisation. They're not meant to run as a PLC. They're meant to be, what's their charter? To make as much money as possible or to help the homeless.
Okay, so you're part of BAM. Can you just say briefly what BAM does?
Well, it's the Bristol Housing Action Movement, and it's basically a squatting organisation, and we will find empty buildings and put people in them that need somewhere to live.
Quite simple. We're a supporting group. We've been around for a long time. We often negotiate or seek more conciliatory things with the owners, but ultimately, if owners do look like they're just bloody-mindedly going to put homeless people on the streets, particularly in this weather, it's freezing, then we will resist. As far as the general public go, I suspect repossessions are going to be, well, I know they're much more common now. They've rocketed in the last 6 months. And we are very sympathetic to those who put all their money in, worked all their lives just to find that they're out back on the streets. And we're quite happy to link up with those people if possible.
That was the Ashley Road squatters, Ben Ritchie and A.N. Other. He wishes to remain anonymous. We'll bring you more on that story as the squatters struggle to stop social housing privatisation. Anyone with a mortgage might well do well to listen. And an exclusive dialect. Two of them apparently will be in next week, they say. So we'll have them live in the studio. Now this is time for some Spinal Tap with the Majesty of Rock.
Roll, the darling of the song, the scoring of the goal, the farmer takes.
was Spinal Tap with The Majesty of Rock.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
It's time once again for another chapter of Cider with Rosie, abridged especially for dialect and read by the actor Malcolm Grieve.
Cider with Rosie by Laurie Lee. Winter was no more typical of our valley than summer. It was not even summer's opposite. It was merely that other place, and somehow one never remembered the journey towards it. One arrived, and winter was here. One's nose went dead so that it hurt to breathe, and there were jigsaws of frost on the window. The light filled the house with a green polar glow, while outside, in the invisible world, there was a strange hard silence, or a metallic creaking, a faint throbbing of twigs and wires. The kitchen that morning would be full of steam, billowing from kettles and pots. The outside pump was frozen again, making a sound like broken crockery, so that the girls tore icicles from the eaves, and we drank boiled ice in our tea. "It's wicked," said Mother. "The poor, poor birds." And she flapped her arms with vigour. There was an iron shod clatter down the garden path, and the milkman pushed the door. The milk in his pail was frozen solid. He had to break off lumps with a hammer. "That's murder out," the milkman said. "Crows worrying the sheep, swans frozen in the lake, and tits dropping dead in mid-air." He drank his tea while his eyebrows melted, slapped Dorothy's bottom, and left. "The poor, poor birds," Mother said again. They were hopping round the windowsill, calling for breads and fats. Robins, blackbirds, woodpeckers, jays, never seen together save now. We fed them for a while, amazed at their tameness, then put on our long wool mufflers. "Can we go out, Mother?" "Well, don't catch cold, and remember to get some wood." First we found some old cocoa tins, punched them with holes, then packed them with smouldering rags. If held in the hand and blown on occasionally, they would keep hot for several hours. They were warmer than gloves and smelt better too. In any case, we never wore gloves. So, armed with these and full of hot breakfast, we stepped out into the winter world. It was a world of glass, sparkling and motionless. Vapours had frozen all over the trees and transformed them into confections of sugar. Everything was rigid, locked up and sealed. And when we breathed the air, it smelt like needles and stabbed our nostrils and made us sneeze. Having sucked a few icicles and kicked the water butt to hear its solid sound, and breathed through the frost on our window pane, we ran up into the road. We hung around, waiting for something to happen. A dog trotted past like a ghost in a cloud, panting his aura around him. The distant fields in the low, weak sun were crumpled like oyster shells. Presently some more boys came to join us, wrapped like Russians with multicoloured noses. We all jumped up and down for a bit, flapped our arms and blew on our cocoa tins. "What are we going to do then, eh?" We quietened down to think. A shuddering, thin boy with his lips drawn back was eating the wind with his teeth. "Giddy up," he said suddenly, and sprang into the air and began whipping himself and whinnying. At that we all galloped away down the road, bucking and snorting, tugging invisible reins and lashing away at our hindquarters. Now the winter's day was set in motion and we rode through its crystal kingdom. We examined the village for its freaks of frost, for anything we might use. We saw the frozen spring by the side of the road, huge like a swollen flower. Water wagtails hovered over it, nonplussed at its silent hardness. and again they dropped down to drink, only to go sprawling in a tumble of feathers. We saw the stream in the valley, black and halted, a tarred path threading through the willows. The church clock had stopped, and the weathercock was frozen, so that both time and the winds were stilled, and nothing, we thought, could be more exciting than this. Interference by a hand unknown, the winter's no to routine and laws. Sinister, awesome, welcome. We went to the farm on the lip of the village, a farm built from a long-gone abbey. Wells, the farmer, had a young sick son, more beautiful than a girl. He waved from the window as he trooped into the farmyard and wouldn't live to last the winter. "Want any help, Mr. Wells?" we asked. He crossed the yard with two buckets on a yoke. As usual, he was dressed in dung. He was small and bald, but had long, sweeping arms that seemed stretched from his heavy labours. "Well, come on," he said. "We're no playing the goat." Inside the cowshed, it was warm and voluptuous, smelling sweetly of milky breath, of heaving hides, green dung and udders, of steam and fermentations. We carried cut hay from the heart of the rick, packed tight as tobacco flake, with grass and wild flowers juicily fossilised within. A whole summer embalmed in our arms. I took a bucket of milk to feed a calf. I opened its mouth like a hot, wet orchid, and it began to suck at my fingers, gurgling in the throat and raising its long-lashed eyes. The milk had been skimmed for making butter, and the calf drank a bucket a day. We drank the same stuff at home sometimes. Mr. Wells sold it for a penny a jug. When we'd finished the feeding, we got a handful of apples and a baked potato each. The apples were so cold they stung the teeth, but the potatoes were hot with butter. We made a dinner of this, then scuffled back to the village, where we ran into the bully, Walt Kerry. "Wanna know summat?" he asked.
"What?"
"Shan't tell you." He whistled a bit and cleaned his ears. He gave out knowledge in very small parcels. "Well, if you wanna know, I may as well..." We waited in a shivering lump. "Jones's pond is bearing," he said at last. "I've been a-sliding on it all morning. Millions been coming with horses and traps and skates and things and all." We tore away down the frosty lane, blood up and elbows well out. "Remember I told you, and I got there first, and I'll be back when I've had me tea." We left him standing in the low pink sun, small as a cankered rose, spiky, thorny, a thing of dread, only to be encountered with shears. We could hear the pond as we ran down the hill, the shouts that only water produces, the squeal of skates, the ring of the ice and its hollow, heaving grumble. Then we saw it, black and flat as a tray, the skaters rolling round it like marbles. We broke into a shout and charged upon it and fell sprawling in all directions. This magic substance, with its deceptive gifts, was something I could never master. It put wings on my heels and gave me the motions of Mercury, then threw me down on my nose. Yet it chose its own darlings, never the ones you supposed. The dromedary louts of the schoolroom, who came skating past with one leg in the air, and twirled and simpered and darted like swifts, and never fell once. Not they. I was one of the pedestrians, and we worked up a slide across the polished darkness, so smooth that to step on it was to glide away while the valley slid past like oil. You could also lie prone and try to swim on the ice, kicking your arms and legs. And you saw, deep down while in that position, little bubbles like cold green stars, jagged, ominous cracks, dead ribbons of lilies, drowned bulrushes, loaded like rockets. The frozen pond on such a winter's evening was a very treadmill of pleasure. Time was uncounted, sensations almost sexual. We played ourselves into exhaustion. We ran and slid till we dripped with sweat. Our scarves were pearled with our breath. The reeds and horsetails at the pond's edge smelt as pungent as old men's fingers. Hanging branches of willow, manacled in the ice, bloomed like lilac in the setting sun. And the frost moon rose through the charcoal trees, and we knew that we'd played too long.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk. www.ashes.co.uk to find out more.
Daleks reporter Lisa Braden recently interviewed Sharon McDonald about her new business, Are You Charmed, which sells New Age goods and services.
I'm Lisa Braden from Dialect Radio, and I'm here today with Sharon McDonald. Hi, Sharon.
Hello, Lisa.
And Sharon runs Are You Charmed? I wonder if you could tell us a bit about it and what you do.
Okay. Are You Charmed is a small business that I've got up and running, and what we do there is I offer New Age goods, products to the public. It's anything from tarot cards, runestones, oils, candles. It's a mixed bag of different products there. You know, we sell crystals, pendants. We also offer tarot readings as well. We also have therapists where you can book therapists, holistic therapists, aura therapists, that type of thing. So it's a good way as well to bring your family and friends along to have a nice night of, you know, psychic awareness. So,
how did you get into it? How did you first realise, oh my God, I'm psychic?
Right, well, that stems back from when I was a little girl. Unfortunately, I lost both of my grandparents at a very young age, and that made me more determined to want to be in contact with them because I just didn't want to lose them totally. So as I was growing up, I always had the feeling that people were watching me. I could feel people around me, but obviously no one was there. And it wasn't till I hit the age of about 14, 15, I actually realised I could see things, I could hear things. And as the years progressed, I progressed. And basically that's where I've got to now. Everything that I can do, that I've given out to other people, is things that I've taught myself through psychic guidance.
So that kind of hit you probably around the time of puberty, because they do say that's quite common, isn't it? That young girls suddenly become far more psychically aware intuitively around that time.
Definitely, definitely. And I've realised now, having three children of my own, you know, and the two older boys are actually coming up to that age, sort of between 14 and 16, that now they are a lot more aware spiritually what is going on, just as I was. So I can see the pattern now, what I went through my children growing up as well.
Can you tell us about one of the most interesting readings and accuracy that you've done? Obviously, you don't have to mention any names. You know, just out of interest for our listeners.
Okay. Well, you know, I've done a fair few readings over the years I've been doing this. One in particular was a lady. She needed some guidance. So basically, I went out there, I gave the reading to the lady, and I said, my love, you're coming to a little bit of money. I said, not a lot, but, you know, enough to put a smile on your face. She said, well, brilliant, I could really do with a bit of help at the moment. And, you know, as the days went and the weeks went on, it could have been a fluke, but she actually went a bingo and won quite a bit of money. So, you know, that was a big bonus. And especially to go out and give someone a reading, that when you first get there, they're very upset, they're very low, they don't know which way to turn. And, you know, you go there, you give them a reading, you give them some sort of guidance, and that guidance to them is security. And the times I've left where they're smiling, and it's so nice because you're actually going out to someone, giving them a reading, and actually helping them and making them feel better. That's the biggest boost of all.
Have you had anything freaky happen to you, like, you know, that it's just so bizarre that it cannot be explained?
No, I can honestly say, and on my heart, I've not actually had anything like that happen. You know, I've gone to places like the Ancient Ram Inn, because I've taught psychic development as well, and, you know, I've took a group of students out there, and, you know, the things that were happening there, well, it was mind-boggling. Even my students couldn't get their head around it. You know, you could physically see shadows, movement. You could feel things touching you and your clothes moving. So to do with what everything that I've done and what I've achieved, I would say that would be the most freakiest, is actually going out on paranormal, knowing what is around you and being aware of what is around you.
So what's next? What's your objective for the future?
My objective? The only thing I can say at the moment is I'm starting to get my New Age parties up and running. Okay. Now, basically, like I said, it's giving the local community as well a chance to get together, because there's far more people out there more interested in this at the moment that meets the eye. A lot of people tend to, you know, follow at the back seat when they don't want people to know, you know, they do like the spiritual side of life. So it's giving people the opportunity to open up to that as well.
Well, thank you very much for your time this morning, Sharon. Can you give me a few contact details if people want to get in touch with you, a phone number, a website?
Yes, I've got a website, Lisa. It's rucharmed.co.uk. I have got a telephone number where people can contact me, and that is 0845 226 0213, or you can email me at rucharmed@hotmail.co.uk.
Sharon McDonald, thank you very much for your time today.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Time to talk punk. I've got Roy D. Hacksaw here in the studio to talk about his punk group Hacksaw, and I understand you have a new album out. Hello.
Hello, yes we do. It's more of a long single than an album. It's about 50 minutes long with 6 remixes, but it's a single.
Okay.
It's not very punk rock to release albums.
All right. How long have Hacksaw been a going concern?
We formed in 1997 for about 3/4 of an hour, and we didn't have our second practice until the year 2000. So we've been going a while, but a bit longer. Depending on when you want to count the start as.
Right, okay. So how many of you are there?
Two.
Two?
Yeah, there's only, and no one else can put up with us. it's just me. I'm the singer and the drummer, and George Hacksaw. He says he's a guitarist, but he does struggle.
So have you got quite a DIY ethos, am I to assume from your tone?
Well, we've got to do it ourselves because no one else will do it for us, really.
Yeah.
We just make a racket and turn up and shout and scream a lot. Oh. And for some reason, people keep rebooking us. We just did our 250th gig a couple of weeks ago. And okay. We're playing all around the country, which isn't bad for two old gimmies we can't play.
Right. So did you know how to play the drums before you started then?
No, first gig I ever did, I'd never played the drums before. Not even for a rehearsal.
That's amazing. I've always fancied the idea of being in a group.
It's easy. If we can do it, you can. Sure. I don't know, actually, looking at you. No, you'll be able to, I'm sure.
Yeah? I don't look very punk, though, do I?
I don't. I'm a 44-year-old fat bloke. Come on. With long hair and... Yeah.
All right. Well, who have you supported over the years?
Over the years? Oh, loads of people. All the old punk rock dinosaurs, like the UK Subs, Pete and the Test Tube Babies... all loads of them, but even people like superstar DJ Danny Rampling at a corporate gig we got once. Many people. I can't think of a single one of them right now.
So how did you go about getting a corporate gig where you were supporting Danny Rampling? That's absolutely schizophrenically bizarre. What was that all about?
I haven't the slightest idea. We just get asked to do these things. For some reason, people think we're going to be a good festival band or a good kind of show band. We can't play a note, but we keep getting booked, so we ain't complaining. Word's got round that we're good for a laugh, and we're quite easy to work with. There's no pop star attitudes going on here because we're too old for that lark.
Okie doke. Well, do you try and I have images of chaos at your gigs, judging by what you say. I do remember my mate went to see Sonic Boom 6, and they tried to persuade the audience to form a human pyramid in the middle of the dance floor and that sort of thing. What entertaining tales do you have to tell?
Sonic Boom 6 are a bit polite. They're a bit nice and clean. They're not really punks. They just pretend to be.
Okay.
We have a lot of audience participation. We try and get the okie cokie going quite often. Mm. What are they called? Piggyback fights here and there. And we have everyone. There's a mass bog roll fight at the end.
Oh, brilliant.
To the song Bog Roll.
Yeah.
Which most of the words are just bog roll.
Okay.
It can go on for anything up to 45 minutes. Our first Ashton Court performance, we managed 100 bog roll salute.
Wow.
Yeah.
Have you ever played with Gurkha?
We haven't, actually. I know Gurkha. We've known him all for years, but we've never shared a bill yet. I'm sure you will at some point.
Oh, no way. Oh, I might have to look into that. So what was what's your new album about? What's your new single, I should say? What's your new single about?
It's a maxi single. It's called Vote Hacksaw, and it's just 11 songs of witless nonsense, really. But the lead track on it's called Go Bath City Go.
Okay.
We're both manic fans of Bath City Football Club, even though we live in Bristol, and we just thought I went to see some other lesser football teams that had really poor songs. But I thought I'll write my nice punk rock football song, and
I've just been passed a note from our resident conspiracy theorist and political nut. He's passed me a little note saying, punk's doing a corporate gig, selling out. What is your riposte to this?
We didn't get paid for it.
Surely that's a matter of
we wanted to do it just to offend people, really.
So what was the audience?
It was Future Publishing's Christmas. No, Summer Do. And it was lots of people in posh clothes. They had a mini Glastonbury. The year Glastonbury wasn't on.
Right.
And they put on a little festival, and it's lots of bands for people that worked at Future and us. And we scared a lot of people. Which is very ace.
Has by your DIY nature and your noise, what criticism have you received? Has anybody ever told you, like, you're rubbish, you should just really stop doing this?
Yeah, well, most gigs.
Yeah?
We keep saying that. Actually, when people book us, we say, we're rubbish, you won't like us. And they go, nah, you're not that bad. And they see us and they go, oh. But we keep getting booked.
So what keeps the home spirits, you know, what keeps the fires burning to keep you going through gig after gig after gig?
It's those faces of complete confusion every time we come on stage. It's that annoyance and confoundment in the eyes of the punters down the front, who are quickly the punters down the back or the punters in the bar.
Okay.
but the three or four people that actually get it and stay up the front and have a lark.
Okay, I'm going to ask you my my Jules Holland question now, because he asks this in every single interview with everybody ever.
You can do the voice.
I'm not sure I can, actually. I'm not far off.
Just hold your nose.
Tell us, what is your earliest memory of music? What is the first music you remember listening to?
My first dateable memory is Mary Hopkin winning Opportunity Knocks with These Were the Days in 1967. November 1967, so it would have been 41 years ago, this week.
Wow, I'm just slightly taken aback that you know like the exact year, even the month.
I think it was November the 17th, but I'm not sure.
November the 17th, but not sure. Right, somebody out there will be nerdly enough to know that, so get in touch with us. Have you any notable gigs coming up? And tell us where we can go and see and where you are.
Well, the next gig, we're playing Bath City Football Club. We're doing a big fundraiser for the supporters club, and also to help launch the single as well. We've got four great punk bands on. Well, three great punk bands and us are on. As Midlife Crisis, which are Chew Magna's premier punk rock covers act, are on.
Okay.
A bunch of kids from Bath called Dead Elvis, who are ace noisy kind of Black Flag nonsense.
Oh,
and
okay.
A band called The Lone Sharks, all older rock and roll gentlemen, just playing some rock and roll punk. And I want everyone to come along and see what Bath City's like and get involved and come support their local football club.
Yeah.
Because there's too many people around here that support Liverpool, Man United, even Bristol City, and that's not good. We want people to support their little local teams.
Yeah.
Bristol Manor Farm, Mangotsfield United, you know, Eastern Cowboys. That's real football. That's not your multi-million kind of business. So get up to Bath City and help out.
Okay, yeah, do that.
Help bring down the structure of Premier League football from within.
Do you play a lot at the Junction? You seem like the kind of band that would.
We do seem to be the house band there. Next gig we're on the Junction, December the 10th with UK Subs.
Okay.
That's our next local gig. We don't play in Bristol much anymore because everyone's sick of us.
Oh.
But we get out and about around the country. We tend to do a gig a week for about the last 6 years, so we keep them busy.
Okay. Well, Roy D. Hacksaw, introduce the track from your new album.
Well, this is Go Bath City Go. It's a lovely little ditty, and you'll be here at Twerton Park every Saturday afternoon just before kick-off.
Okay. Oh, yeah, and last but not least, do you have an obligatory MySpace or an internet presence?
Yes.
What is it?
Slash Hacksaw Bristol.
Slash
after all the MySpace business. And
okay.
Hacksaw Bristol, because Hacksaw was taken up by the American wrestler Jim Hacksaw Duggan, so we couldn't have that.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, I've been going around MySpace collecting all the hacksaws around the world. I want to try and put in a gig of bands entirely called Hacksaw.
Yeah.
I've got a Portuguese grindcore band who are ace. They sent me a t-shirt. There's a Dutch kind of like murdercore band. There's some band from Washington who play kind of sludge rock. So we're going to try and have a Hacksaw festival. And the bill's only going to be like 9 o'clock, Hacksaw. 9:45, Hacksaw. So I'm not telling anyone who they are. So that's the plan. It won't happen because it's pie in the sky nonsense, but that's the plan.
Okay. Well, very best of luck. I'm going to shake.
Thank you very much. Oh, thank you very much.
That doesn't really work on radio. But...
No, but you put the hand out, so I thought I'd better show.
Well, yeah.
Thank you for having me.
Listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
This week to tell us what we can go out and do in these cold winter months to warm the cockles of our hearts.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Friday 14th of November at the Trinity Centre in Bristol, Zion Train will be performing with support from Dub from Atlantis. The gig will start around 9 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. Also on 14th of November and at the Prom Bar in Bristol, Heat will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £4 on the door. On to a song of the week, and I've decided to feature something totally and completely different. This is a Rudolf Kallmann performing Caprice No. 5, which was composed by Paganini in the 18th century. Thank you. That was Rudolf Coleman performing Caprice number 5. Now that Caprice has had an influence on many guitarists, one of them being Steve Vai, who performed a variation of the piece in the guitar duel scene in the 1986 film Crossroads. Moving on to Saturday 15th of November, and at the Folk House in Bristol, Oh the Woe Promotions and Self to Notes presents Into My Arms, a night devoted to Nick Cave. Performing at the gig will be many acts, including War Against Sleep, North Sea Navigator and Caroline Martin. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £6 each. Also on 15th of November and at the Croft in Bristol, Fortune Drive will be performing with support from the Speedwell Intervention and also Howlin' Lord. Doors open at 9 p.m. and tickets are £7 in advance. Finally, on Sunday 16th of November, at Moles Club in Bath, Joe Public will be performing with support from Spires and also CB1. Doors open at 9 p.m. and entry is £3.50 for members and £4 for guests. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Howlin' Lord is always good value for money, so if Fortune Drive, you've never heard of them, well, go and see him anyway, because get to see Howlin' Lord. He's a personal friend of mine. That's the end of this week's Dialect Show from the Bristol Radio Co-op, based here in the city centre, right by Queen Square. Today's studio guests were Sue Fairbanks and Roy D. Haxall. Thank you very much to them both. Remember, Haxall are coming up soon, playing around in Bristol and in Bath, so check them out, myspace.com/HaxallBristol. Our features were brought to us by Dialect reporters Tony Gosling and Lisa Braden. A note on Tony Gosling's feature, the Bristol Housing Action Association can be found on the web at squatbristol.org.uk. And just a reminder, we've got two of the squatters coming in next week to speak on the show. Malcolm Greaver had another instalment of Cider with Rosie to be continued next week. What's On was presented by Jeff Spark and Mark Condon was the studio engineer. This week's show was produced by Jeff Sparks. You can download the show on the internet at www.dialectradio.co.uk. It's goodbye from all here at Dialect Radio and myself, John Beaters Coleman. Until next week, goodbye, take care of yourselves.